Hi, and welcome to Outthink. I'm Lawrence Akers, clinical hypnotherapist, member of the LGBTQI community, and a passionate advocate for mental health. Today we're talking with counsellor and family violence worker Anthony Lickus around the topic of same-sex domestic violence. Now, welcome Anthony.
Hi, Lawrence, thanks.
Firstly, this is a topic that I think perhaps the community isn't so aware about. What is it, do you think, that makes this topic almost hidden from our community?
I think because most of the conversations that are had around domestic violence are largely around heterosexual family violence, where we often think about the victim being a woman, a straight woman, and the perpetrator being a straight male. And for very good reasons, the dominant message in sort of mainstream and I guess in various discourses are around that particular profile of family violence. So I guess the consequence of that has been that members of our community and the queer community, it means that and I often see this in my work, that people often come in and don't identify with family violence when it occurs in their relationships because they see it as a straight issue, something that happens in straight relationships.
So what is the reaction then when you raise a term like domestic violence? How do they respond to that?
I think that often people will, unless there is physical violence happening in their relationship, that they won't necessarily think it's them or it applies to them. Mm-hmm. I think that often there's I think the queer community where we're at with family and relationship violence in terms of services and responses, we're probably where the mainstream community was maybe 20 or 30 years ago. We're really at the point of community education. We're really just trying to get the word out to let people know that, yes, this is something that happens in our relationships. It's a real issue in the queer community, and this is what it looks like. And we are just sort of starting to provide services that are, I guess, specifically tailored to respond to domestic violence for members of the queer community. I mean, having said that, there are very limited resources and services out there for us, but it is a very real conversation in the sector around sort of what do we do for our community.
So let's explore this idea then of domestic violence. What exactly does domestic violence look like?
So it's a good question because I've worked with perpetrator programs for about 8 years, and I think that often people think that it's largely just physical abuse, sexual abuse, destroying property, or even making a threat to somebody's life. Now those four things are definitely violence. Those things are listed in the Crimes Act as criminal offences, and that's probably why people understand those things as being abusive, because you can be charged with a criminal offence. The other forms of violence that aren't so clear-cut in the eyes of the law that are actually not criminal offences are the ones that are often more invisible forms of violence. And this is really when we get down to the nitty-gritty. This is where people start to wonder about whether or not this is actually domestic violence or is it not? And that's things like emotional abuse, psychological abuse, financial control, social abuse or social monitoring of your partner, checking up on them, stalking in some cases, as stalking is actually a criminal offence. And also spiritual abuse. And I guess spiritual abuse, the types of sort of controlling and power over behaviours that prevents your partner from practicing their spirituality, or even if you are practicing a particular religion, then the misuse of scripture to dominate your partner, to demean them or humiliate them. So I guess at the end of the day, family violence, as it's listed in the Family Violence Protection Act, it's in the legislation, really refers to any behaviour that causes the affected family member or the person being subjected to those behaviours, that causes that person to feel intimidated, apprehensive, controlled, dominated, afraid, in an ongoing way. So I think that that's the difference between... physical violence only needs to occur once for the impact of that to be sort of lifelong for that person in the relationship.
Absolutely.
So it's not really around how often they occur, but it's more about impact. What's the impact on the victim?
In your experience with the people that you've seen, what have been some of the more common abuses that have occurred?
I think I do couples counselling as well, and I've got to say I see this come up in couples counselling, which is not a family violence service. Couples counselling is a therapeutic forum, and often family violence work is not about therapeutic work. We can talk about that in a second, but I mean, it's common that people will get reactive and raise their voices and maybe even swear occasionally in relationships. They might even slam the door on the way out the room and these sorts of things. I guess we wouldn't be so quick to conclude that this is family violence, because we need to understand what is the impact on the other person when these things occur. And if these behaviors are used as tactics of abuse or control, these behaviors in a family violence setting tend to be used as a way of sending messages to the other person that they need to be careful with their responses, that there are consequences to them if they respond in a way that doesn't fit with the perpetrator's needs and interests. I mean, that's I guess to answer your question, the most common forms, I guess verbal abuse is something people are willingly disclosing in our programs. Physical violence tends to be disclosed, I guess, once they've been charged with a criminal offence and they've gone to court for it, so that it's already out there. But it does, I mean, it is difficult when we work with people who use violence in their relationships. They do often minimise their behaviour. They make a lot of excuses for the use of those behaviours, and they often hide the behaviours by not talking about them.
Do you think there's like an underlying shame that goes on there with, I guess, for both parties in that sense, like the shame of hitting the other person and the shame of being hit and not wanting to bring that to the surface and appearing weak?
I think that's one of the very much the case, I guess, with both the person using the behaviour and the one experiencing the behaviour. Shame is very much a theme that we see in the work. But I guess on the side of the perpetrator, it's also a denial or a refusal to accept responsibility for it. So not talking about it is a way of sort of hiding and not being called to account.
Or I guess even just minimising it, saying, you know, or even normalising it, I guess, perhaps saying, well, I'm sure every couple have those moments where they get physical.
Well, that's a good point, because in our community, in the queer community, it can be normalised. I mean, when we talk about two men in a relationship where we often think about the expression of masculinity to be sort of associated with aggression in some way, or dominance, or competitiveness, and these characteristics might emerge in a same-sex male relationship, and often the two people in the same-sex relationship, I've heard men say that, you know, it's nothing serious, it's just the way we are, or this sort of perpetuates a myth that because it's two men, then it's a mutual fight, or it's equal, or it's not a power over kind of situation. And that's one of the myths, I think, that harms us as a community, because it erases the fact that family violence is a real issue in same-sex male relationships. And often in my work with partners of the men who come to our men's behaviour change program at VAC, Victorian AIDS Council, I hear a very different story, that they don't feel that it's mutual at all, that they feel like they have to adjust their behaviour, and that they stop behaving in an open and free way as to avoid potential reactions by their partner or possible consequences, and that they do that in an ongoing way where they start to find themselves feeling oppressed in the relationship. Now, the perpetrators come to the program and they report that things are great in the relationship. I haven't used violence in a long time. You know, they're often talking about physical violence, and things seem great. You know, we're having sex again. We're going to the movies. We went out to the pill on the weekend. We partied all night. Everything's fine. And when we look at this more closely and we talk to the partner, we often see that the partner is working very hard to be responsive to the perpetrator's needs, to not say no, to not challenge, to go along with. And that's really what domestic violence, the essence of domestic violence, is about. It's all that sort of private and invisible work that the victim does to keep themselves safe.
Once the relationship has reached that stage where even if the perpetrator has stepped back and, for want of a better word, began to reform, and the partner is still feeling that threat, still feeling that fear, what can the partner do to help to start to step away from that and to hopefully get the relationship back on track?
It's a tricky question to answer because often our emphasis is on what the perpetrator can do differently, not Absolutely. So much what the partner does. So we're really wanting the person using violence to stop the abuse, to acknowledge that they are using violence and to understand the impact. And I guess we would do a lot of work around empathy, around understanding whether or not they're interested in reviewing the way that they behave in that relationship, and understand the consequences of not changing. Because often, I mean, it's sort of, I guess it is a common response for us to sort of ask questions about the victim. You know, why do they stay if it's so abusive and violent? With the partners I've worked with, I often hear them say that it's the violence that they want to stop, not the relationship.
Yeah.
That there are many parts of the relationship that they value and appreciate and have worked hard to support, and they're heavily invested into that relationship. And I guess with the something that I'm learning more and more about victims' experiences, and something that we know from mainstream statistics around with women, that the highest risk period for women in family violence situations is when they're leaving or if they've left the relationship. So those first few weeks around separation is the time that she's most likely to be killed by her partner or former partner. And I think that it could be similar for same-sex male relationships, although we don't have enough research around this. We don't have enough information in the literature for us to conclude that with certainty. But I think if women's experiences are anything to go by, I think that there are some parallels definitely with what I'm learning about the partner's experiences. Because to try and leave a controlling man who is determined to see you as his possession, to have things happen on his terms, leaving that man can be very risky. There's a lot of careful thought and planning and preparation that occurs, and partners know how dangerous it can be to leave, which is what keeps them in the relationship sometimes.
Are there any shared common traits amongst the profile of the perpetrator?
No, and I think one of the biggest misconceptions about what perpetrators look like is that they are men who have either been in jail, who have shaved, I don't know where shaved heads comes from, but, you know, tattoos, missing teeth, you know, like that, the you know, the family violence doesn't discriminate, I guess, depending on your class, social class or age or ethnicity and even sexual orientation, that we have men who come to our men's behavior change program who are teachers, who are factory workers, who are people who are unemployed, who are people who are also counselors and therapists. We've in mainstream spaces, I've worked with lawyers, I've worked with policemen. It's white collar, blue collar, it covers, I guess, every aspect of social life, regardless of what sort of specific characteristics you have.
Mm. Who tends to approach the counselling process first? Is it often more the perpetrator, or is it often more the person that's been abused?
We often see the victim survivors come in for counselling to get some individual counselling, I guess because of perhaps their experience of stress, maybe even depression, anxiety, which they don't often connect to what's going on in their relationship. But also we have it's a mixed bag, really, because often we have couples who come in, particularly in the queer community, that they come in and they say that we need relationship counselling, we need couples counselling, we've got, you know, we both agree that, you know, our fighting needs to be worked on and this isn't great, and or one of them will initiate the counselling and the other one might come reluctantly. And it's at that point, at the Victorian AIDS Council, we have a very I guess, rigorous screening process where we will speak to each partner individually before we have any joint sessions. And that process is important for us to screen for family violence and also educate the couple on if, in fact, we conclude that it is family violence based on the screening tools that we use, that we will help to educate them as to why we believe that that's the case and why we think it's important that we offer them individual work before we race into doing any joint work. The risk of doing couples counselling when family violence is an issue is that in couples counselling, there's an assumption that both partners are equally they equally contribute to the conflict and the relationship patterns that emerge between them in the relationship. And if there's a safety issue or a family violence matter happening there, then it unfairly attributes part of the blame of the violence that the victim is experiencing on the victim. It's an incredibly dangerous and horrible message to send that person, and very harmful, and can perpetuate further violence.
For people that are listening to this, I imagine there are obviously some that are in relationships and potentially some that are in abusive relationships but may not recognize it. How would they know that they're in a relationship that could be labeled as abusive?
I think that would be for them to decide. How does it feel for that person? Do they feel controlled or dominated? Do they feel that they have to? I mean, we all have to sort of adjust and change the way that we behave and participate in a relationship, because, you know, some things might upset our partners, and other things that they might enjoy doing that we don't enjoy doing but we do. So I guess it comes down to what feels safe as opposed to what's uncomfortable, or what we have to, you know, maybe resentfully attend to, you know, our in-laws, you know, Christmas dinner or something like that. But I think it's about sort of where, you know, if it feels unsafe, if it feels like there are some consequences for you because of a decision that you make, or if you find yourself really adjusting your behavior and are constantly focusing on the other person's needs, then I guess if power and control is very much one-sided in the relationship, that would be a concern. I mean, again, I wouldn't be so quick to conclude right now that is domestic violence or an abusive relationship. It does require a lot of conversation and examination, but I mean, definitely if any criminal offences have occurred, like physical abuse, if there has been any police intervention at any point, then, you know, we'd be asking some questions. We would have some concerns. A history of intervention orders as well. There are some indicators to suggest whether or not the risk is increased or decreased.
What advice would you generally give people who feel that they are in an abusive relationship and perhaps don't know at this point in time what they need to do, or perhaps feeling trapped?
If you have any concerns for your immediate physical safety, I would call 000. I think it's about 40 to 45% of the police force's workload is to address and respond to family violence matters in the community. So almost half of their work. So Gabby Tayak, who is the gay and lesbian liaison officer in the northwestern region, who's a very popular friend of ours here in the queer community. She works closely with our program revisioning, the Men's Behaviour Change Program at the Victorian AIDS Council. We often consult with her. Victims can also make a request to either speak to her or the local gay and lesbian liaison officer at the local police station if they just want to get some advice around, or just to sort of talk through, look, I'm not sure if this is abuse. I don't know. I'd just like some information or just some advice about what I can do, or are these criminal offences? Police can have a conversation with that person without necessarily actioning anything, without the sort of, I guess, victim's permission. The other thing is that they can call the Victorian AIDS Council on 9865 6700, we can have a conversation with you also. We can invite you in for an assessment for us to have a look at your experience of the relationship and some of the things that might be occurring in it and what services that we can offer to support you to feel safer. And also, if you're using violence in a relationship, or if you're worried about some of your reactions towards your partner or the ways that you've been behaving, then I would also encourage you to call VAC and come in, and we have a couple of different services that we can offer you. One is our Men's Behaviour Change Program to support you to be a safer person to be in a relationship with.
Yeah. I guess, what as a counsellor, what kind of emotional states do you experience when they first come in? And where are you want him to go, or not so much where you want him to go, I guess that's a stupid question. Where do you hope that they go emotionally?
The person using the violence?
Yeah.
I guess empathy for their partner is my main priority. Mm-hmm. Their partner's experience of the abuse is my guiding platform, I guess. It's where I draw my questions from. It's how I understand my role. The person who uses violence, I'm very interested to, see if they are also interested in taking their partner's version of the violence on board, mm-hmm. as the true version of what's happening in the relationship, because like you said earlier around shame, we know that people use violence will sanitize the story. Yep. They will present it in a way that perhaps is less shaming for them, but also it might sound to them, they might construct it in a way that sounds more socially acceptable. And I understand they might do that to manage their own the worry of judgment being viewed negatively, their own experience of shame. We can talk about shame. We do that work, but also sometimes we need to sort of think about what does that mean for their partner if they're working very hard not to go anywhere near and a feeling, mm-hmm. that might connect them more closely with the impact of the violence. I mean, that would be concerning for me if they're putting more energy into avoiding taking responsibility and confronting the version of the violence that their partner's presenting to them, even if it makes them feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because if they are working very hard not to go anywhere near that experience, then I would worry about the capacity to truly empathize with their partner.
How many of them actually do embrace, because I know when we're talking about something like toxic shame, quite often people that are touched by toxic shame will undeniably place blame elsewhere. It'll be the whole, that person did something that made me go into a rage, that made me hit them, or, you know, that person is doing this behavior and I'm doing this to protect them, but it's actually controlling. How many of them actually do take on responsibility for that shame, and how many of them just flat out deny it, push back on it?
Look, it's hard to know, because in the program, we run a 12-week program, which we're reviewing at the moment, and we're looking at extending that to 24 weeks to comply with the minimum standards for men's behavior change programs, which is also currently under review. But, well, we only get 12 weeks with the men, and sometimes men who come to the group might say and behave in ways that seem to be fairly responsive to the program. They may appear to really take things on board and say the right things and respond in ways that indicate to us as facilitators that they are really working with this material and having a real go. Our work with partners, because a requirement of the program is that we have contact with their partners or ex-partners. Sometimes we hear a very different story from their partners. We might hear in the same night that they've come to the group and they've participated in a very positive way and have been actually quite useful in the group, and that they've gone home and behaved in controlling and abusive ways. That's not uncommon. So that's not to say that, I don't believe that change is possible. I wouldn't do this work if I didn't think it was possible. So, but I guess what I'm saying is it takes a long time. That's why the groups are moving from a 12-week minimum standard to a 24-week minimum standard. So look, I don't know. We can't do this work without getting information from partners. There is a lot of debate around in the sector around what needs to happen with men's behavior change programs. Here at VAC, we run the only men's behavior change program for same gender attracted men in the country. Maybe in the world, actually. I'm being bold by saying that, but I'm not sure. I don't know of another program internationally that is a group intervention for same-sex attracted men.
Even if it is just Australia, that's quite astounding in some ways. And I think it highlights what you were saying before about the fact that as a community, we don't really know and understand much about same-sex domestic violence.
It's true because, and we don't, and we need to start having these conversations more publicly. And I think that for mainstream groups, there are wait lists upon wait lists of men who have been not only mandated through courts or the criminal justice system, but men who are supposedly attending sort of, or wanting to attend voluntarily. You're looking at it, but anywhere from a 2 to 6 months wait to get into a mainstream group if you're a straight male. For our group, we don't have a wait list. We don't have large numbers who come of same gender attracted men who come to this group. The referrals are not coming through like you would in mainstream groups. The infrastructure in the family violence sector is not adequately set up to really get the same numbers into this group as they are for straight groups. And that's we can unpack that and sort of try and sort of understand why, but heterosexism might be an issue, that the lack of services and the lack of emphasis or even sort of public campaigns around family violence is not targeted towards same gender attracted men or queer relationships, which again reinforces the message that it may not be an issue for you lot. So
prior to recording, you were talking a little bit about the impact of domestic violence on things like the economy. Can you perhaps share a little bit about that?
I think annually, and the reports from the Vic Health website, the last time I checked, I think it was 24 point something billion dollars a year. Don't quote me on that figure. It's definitely in the billions, and it's looking, and there's a figure that was released that it's looking to, rise substantially by 2040. You might want to check out the Vic Health website, but, look, the cost, I guess, comes down to spending money on things like the resources that are used to respond to incidences of family violence at people's properties, at police interventions, the courtroom processes, community corrections and criminal justice programs, men's behavior change programs, women's services, refuges. Things like absenteeism from workplaces because of injuries. We know that family violence is the leading cause of death, disability and injury to women aged between, I think it's 16 and 44 in Victoria. Yes. And that's pretty astounding. And if there are some comments in the literature, in queer literature, that suggests that similar rates occur for the LGBTI community of family violence. I know that in Scotland there was a report that was released. It's called Out of Sight, Out of Mind, that indicated that trans women were at significantly higher rates of being killed than heterosexual women in heterosexual family relationships where family violence was an issue. So we know it's an issue in our community, definitely. Mm.
I know that this conversation may have felt very gay-focused in some ways. So I'm glad you mentioned trans women there, because I was just thinking in my mind, what about the lesbian community and the trans community in terms of domestic violence? Is there any information around that?
Not a lot. Most of the work that we're doing at VAC is very much tailored towards same gender-attracted men. We are going to be moving into the trans space to provide support services for trans women, and that we are doing some work in the lesbian space at VAC also. But in terms of domestic violence, it's an emerging area for our organisation, and we're to get funding to allow us to do more comprehensive work more broadly in our community is an issue also. However, for victims in our community, whether they are LGBTI, we do have a funded program which is called the Flexi Support Package Program, which is basically it allows us to provide brokerage funds to support people in the LGBTI community who are subjected to violence to feel safer, to be free from a relationship where abuse and violence has occurred. And that's around things like helping them to relocate, to support them to live independently, whatever that means. Sometimes we've even been able to help people with having access to transport, like buying their MyQ cards, or it's, in some instances we can even buy them a car. Nothing too fancy. Can't get them a Mercedes Benz, but you know, we can sort of, if that helps to increase their safety and maintain their independence away from family and domestic violence, then we can definitely look at that. That's more of a case management service at our organisation, and that's for all members of the LGBTI community.
Yeah.
In terms of perpetrator programs, we are at this stage only offering the revisioning program, which is the men's behaviour change program.
Great, and obviously we'll place full information about both those programs on our website, so if people wish to have a look at that, they can jump on there and download the scan PDFs that I'll pop up there as well. And before recording, you're also talking about a upcoming cabaret show that I guess has something of a twist about it.
Yes, there's a cabaret show that's going to be on in July. It's called My Other Closet, the Cabaret. You can go to myothercloset.thecabaret.com for more information. And that's Matthew Parsons and Russ Vickers to same-sex attracted men. They are partners. They're in a relationship together. And before they partnered, they both had come out of and left abusive partners. So they're both survivors of domestic violence in gay relationships. The violence and abuse that they both experienced was horrendous. And there's something really special about their relationship because they both in the performing arts industry as well. I know Matthew is very much involved in the family violence space in the queer community also. So they got together and they decided to put on a cabaret show. This was very much a cathartic experience for them. Mm. It is a one-man cabaret show. It's Russ's experience of living in a family violence situation and also leaving it. And they can be two very different processes and there's a courageous story that unfolds throughout the play, and he breaks out into song, which is brilliant. it is entertaining. It's quite moving. It's confronting. There's a compelling, illustration of the very, subtle ways that partners can have their grip on you when you're feeling dominated and controlled in your relationship, and just how confusing and embarrassing it can feel, the fear of public and exposure, the visibility around it, even for the victim, can be quite shaming, and that can keep them locked into that relationship. I won't say too much about the play because I'd like the listeners to check out the website and go and get your tickets. It's a brilliant play. You won't be disappointed. It's incredibly reasonably priced. And I think it's the opening night is on July 15.
Where's it at?
I think the Trades Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it'll be, details are on the website. It's, My Other Closet, the Cabaret. It's probably the closest I've ever gotten to a victim's experience of family violence, and because I work mainly with perpetrators, but I've worked with victims over the years also in counselling. But and I say it's the closest I've gotten because the show takes you on a bit of a journey, and it is it's so sophisticated in how it is able to present the nuances and the challenges and the pain and suffering that occurs, but also the courage and the resilience it takes for individuals. Because we often have this idea that victims are powerless, they're cowering over in a corner, they're in fetal position, they're chained up to the bed when their partners are home, these sorts of things. And often that they are resisting the violence in ways that helps to keep themselves safe, and they are grappling with the decision, or do I stay, do I go? And they have enormous strength and resilience, and Russ really is able to sort of shine that through in the show. It's a fantastic show. I really encourage you
to watch. It sounds incredible. Yeah, definitely one I think everyone should go and check out. Anthony, thank you so much for your time today and allowing us to come into the VAC and to spend this time with you. If people did wish to get in touch with you or any of the team at VAC, what's the best way for them to do that?
So they can call our intake, the counselling service, on 9865 6700. They can check out the VAC website. It's www.vacvac.org.au. All our information on our services are listed on the website. And if anyone listening actually just wants to have a chat with me personally as well, I'm happy to do that also. They can call the main number.
Thank you so much for your time, Anthony. Really appreciate it, especially a topic that, you know, I think is so undercover in so many ways. To be able to bring that to light on this podcast has been really fascinating and worthwhile.
Great. It's been a pleasure.
We look forward to everyone joining us next fortnight for the next podcast. Until then, please stay safe.